I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Tomorrow, Russia's President Vladimir Putin turns 73, 6 years younger than his Alaska summit partner, Donald Trump. This while the proxy war on Russia rages through Ukraine and the international community condemns the UK-US-EU armed war on Palestine. It's clear that NATO nations fighting the proxy war are in deep economic trouble, unlike Russia, now the strongest economy in Europe by PPP. But as Trump fails to save US diplomatic hegemonic power against BRICS and the SCO, what of Trump's attempts to save U.S. economic hegemonic power? If you believe the NATO propaganda and media, it's all about just tariffs and sanctions. But is Trump's economic policy much more complex, and is dollar devaluation and military power at its heart? It's just over 40 years since the U.S. signed the Plaza Accord with its Cold War vassal states at a New York hotel. Back then, Reagan was backing apartheid South Africa, smuggling weapons to death squads in Central America, trying to control Lebanon and pouring arms to brutally installed dictators in the Philippines, Indonesia, and Zaire. So what is the Mar-a-Lago Accord amidst Trump military attacks on Iran, Yemen, Somalia, and many nations via proxy Israel? Joining me again from Portsmouth in New Hampshire in the USA is best-selling economics author and former Pentagon advisor Jim Rickards. When he's not advising presidents and the U.S. intelligence community, he is the best-selling author of books like Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis, and he's editor of Strategic Intelligence and guest lecturer on globalization and finance at the Johns Hopkins University and on financial warfare at the U.S. Army War College. Jim, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Tumultuous times even since you came on last to talk about ChatGPT and AI and flash crashes. What is the Mar-a-Lago Accord? And why is no one except us in a moment talking about the Mar-a-Lago Accord?
Well, thank you, Afshin. It's great to be with you. So the Mar-a-Lago Accord, actually the first person who came up with that phrase and described it was me in my book, Aftermath, came out in 2019, chapter six. It's called the Mar-a-Lago Accord. So I was the first one to explore the territory. But to your point, more recently, last November 2024, Stephen Moran, who was at a think tank at the time, he has since become chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House and recently took a seat on the Board of Governors of the U.S. Federal Reserve System, our central bank. So he's got an executive branch seat and a central bank seat, which is unusual, but nothing prohibiting that. So he's quite influential in terms of the White House. But he wrote a paper, and it's available from you can find it online very easily. Just kind of put in his name and put Mar-a-Lago Accord, you'll find it. It's very densely written. It's about 25 pages, you know, single space. It takes a little doing, but I do recommend it for people who are interested. But he describes the Mar-a-Lago Accord. Now, it has several aspects to it. The first one, and the most obvious, are tariffs. The U.S. we're going to put on tariffs in the rest of the world. There's a minimum of 10. Some of them go up to, we just put 50% tariffs on Indian exports because they're doing business with Russia. Some of them may be as high as 100% when all is done. The market has kind of absorbed it after the shock in April. But that really is just going back to what the United States did through most of its history. From 1790 to 1962, the U.S. was completely tariff-driven. It was only in recent decades, the late 20th century and more recently, that we got caught up in globalization and the World Trade Organization and Doha and other rounds of tariff reduction, all of which was a huge mistake economically on the part of the United States. But we're getting back to what we always did, going all the way back to Alexander Hamilton. So that's the first and most obvious point. But then he goes into very different territory. He said, well, if I put a tariff on you, you can easily beat the tariff by devaluing your currency. Because if you devalue your currency relative to the dollar, then the price of your export drops in terms of dollars. So on the one hand, tariff raises the price, but the currency devaluation drops the price, and you can come out about even with a, you know, say a 15% currency devaluation. And what Moran says is, don't you dare. If you're a trading partner of the United States, don't dare think about cheapening your currency as a way to dilute or defeat our tariffs. By the way, this was one of the subjects of my first book, Currency Wars. Now, So, that's fine as a declaration. How are you actually going to enforce that? How are you going to keep other countries from devaluing their currency as a way to dilute the tariffs? And he creates what I call the traffic light system. He doesn't use that exact term, but that's what it is. He divides the world into red, yellow, and green. So green, you're a friend of the United States, you're a good trading partner. We might put tariffs on you, but they're not extremely high. And you're not trying to devalue your currency. So you're kind of doing things our way. Yellow, you're a friend, trading partner, but you know, maybe you are devaluing your currency. Maybe your tariffs are going to be a little bit higher. You're okay, but you're not exactly playing by our rules. Red is you're an enemy, you're an adversary. You are devaluing, you're putting tariffs on us, et cetera, and you're probably a geopolitical strategic enemy or at least rival or adversary, et cetera. So green are the friends, red are the enemies, and yellow are, you know, somewhere in between, but probably okay, but not on the A-list. Okay, that's an interesting system, Steve Moran. How are you going to enforce that? How are you going to back up that system and get the kind of compliance, the green lights that you're looking for? Now, here he veers way into national security. I think he's out of his depth. I don't think he knows exactly what he's doing. But he says the U.S. security umbrella, including the nuclear umbrella as needed, will extend to everyone on the green list, the so-called green light. And you know, everyone else is kind of, you know, you're not protected if you're yellow, or you may be an enemy if you're red. This is a bigger, broader version of the original petrodollar deal from 1974, which I worked on with the White House at the time, when we said to Saudi Arabia, okay, we will guarantee your security vis-a-vis Iran and other adversaries. So you, the Saudis, have to agree to stabilize your currency, price oil in dollars. And that wasn't just about the Saudi Arabians getting dollars. Once you price oil in dollars, everybody needs oil. That means everybody needs dollars to buy the oil, which was the main prop or floor, if you will, behind the status, the role of the U.S. dollar ever since, as the leading reserve currency. Now, Moran's just applying that on a broader basis. I worry about a number of things. Number one, I'm all for broad thinking, out-of-the-box thinking, but I think Moran should stick to his lane in terms of maybe tariffs and maybe foreign exchange, but not sort of play the national security card. Kissinger did it, James Baker did it, but they were both... Kissinger was National Security Advisor, later Secretary of State. James Baker was Secretary of Treasury at the time of the Plaza Accord, later became Secretary of State. I don't see Moran as a Secretary of State candidate. So,
I mean, clearly he has a lot of influence. Before we get to the more exciting part, which you intimate, the military element, what are these other points? So there's dollar devaluation, tariffs, penalizing holders of treasuries and restructuring long debt holdings. Just go through why part of the Mar-a-Lago Accord would involve penalizing holders of U.S. treasuries. And we know that China is unwinding its U.S. treasury holdings. And in Tianjin, all the talk was, this was a bad thing for the United States and U.S. economic hegemony. What is the penalizing holders of treasury angle in the Mar-a-Lago Accord?
Well, I think that's a little bit of an extrapolation from what's actually there when you read the paper. But he is talking about what they call century bonds. Century bonds are 100-year obligations. And it sounds like, well, it's a long time. I won't be around in 100 years. But they say, who's going to buy them? Well, the answer is that there would be a ready market for those. There are, you know, endowments, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, others with long-term liabilities want long-term assets so they can pair the two of them off. So there would be a ready market for 100-year bonds. They'd have interest rate. It could be quite low, actually. The British did this. They used to have something called consols. Consols had no maturity. They were theoretically infinite. Now, His Majesty's Treasury could buy them back, and that's how they redeemed them. But they didn't have a maturity. They just paid, interest for forever, basically, until they were redeemed. So you could sell the century bonds. But the problem is, we have a debt ceiling. The Treasury can only have a certain amount of securities outstanding at any one time. Now, that is routinely raised. I'm not saying it's an impediment to financing the U.S. government, but at any point in time, there's a debt ceiling. If you start issuing these 100-year bonds, which Moran does talk about in the paper, that's going to crowd out some other securities. There'll be less of something. The thing that there'll be less of, probably Treasury bills. Now, a lot of people say, well, gee, that's a good thing. The U.S. government is financing itself, you know, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months at a time. You continually have to roll it over. Wouldn't it be great to get rid of those and have some 100-year bonds and not have to worry about it for a long period of time? The people who say that actually don't understand how the government securities market works. I spent a long time counseled one of the primary dealers. We're the ones who actually talk to the Fed every day. The Fed only deals with so-called primary dealers, and my former firm was one of them. So we talk to the Fed all the time. Here's the thing. Treasury bills, the short term, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, up to 1 year, are the most liquid, safest instruments around. They form collateral for derivatives transactions. There are $1 quadrillion of notional value of derivatives on the books, or actually off the books in the footnotes of banks, hedge funds, and other players. For people not familiar with the Q word, a quadrillion is 1,000 trillion. That's how much is outstanding. But all of that is supported with a little layer of collateral that I would send to you, or you would send to me, and that the best collateral are Treasury bills. So if you start issuing century bonds and having fewer Treasury bills, you're going to dry up collateral for the biggest market in the world and perhaps cause a catastrophe. I don't think Moran understands
that. But that's why it has to be done carefully. But the main aim, isn't it, is to reduce the debt, ultimately, the devaluation, using this Treasury's element to the Mar-a-Lago Accord. And then suddenly in this fifth point of conditioning economic support on U.S. military base positioning in, and that's actually explicitly said, which is quite strange for a dry economic paper. What's the significance of the need for military bases in these quasi-vassal states of the global south and in Western Europe?
Right. Well, the U.S. has bases all over the world, and I guess we want a few more. But the point being, that is an important point on national security policy. I don't personally favor all these bases, but, you know, I'm not in charge of the Pentagon. But my point is, why is Moran?
Yeah, you talk to the Pentagon.
Well, I do. I teach financial warfare at the U.S. Army War College. But I'll leave that to others. But my point is, why is an economist like Moran talking about it at all? He's not Henry Kissinger or Helmut Sonnenfeld or some of the architects of the original petrodollar accord. So I think he's over his skis there. I think these century bonds will have unintended consequences, which I described by drying up the issuance of bills. The U.S. debt is not going down. The U.S. debt is never going down. The deficit's never going to get paid off. Talk about that as kind of nonsense. It doesn't matter. Here's what does matter. The debt to GDP ratio. That's the number to watch. People say, oh, the U.S. is $37 trillion in debt. Well, that's a big number. I get it. But you can't think about that in isolation, or not meaningfully. You have to think about it relative to GDP. What are the resources and the income available to service the debt? That's the right way to think about it. Right now, that ratio is at an all-time high. That's not a good thing. But the point is, what Scott Bessent's trying to do, and Moran's contributing to this, is trying to reduce the ratio. If you do that, then you have a sustainable situation. By the way, it's not true that the Chinese are dumping Treasury bonds.
I didn't say dumping.
Comes out with a report. Okay, they're not reducing their holdings significantly. Not in the last 6 months. They did do some of it last year. You're right. They reduced their holdings. But when they do that, you're right, they're not dumping them. They wish they had more. What they're doing, there is a global dollar shortage. The Chinese are in a liquidity crisis. When they sell treasuries, they're getting cash to prop up the currency and prop up the banks. When central banks say we have reserves in dollars, people don't understand how reserves work. Reserves are not in dollars, they're in securities. Now, they're denominated in dollars, yes, that's right, but they're not actually dollars. You don't have stacks of $100 bills in the basement of the People's Bank of China.
I'll stop you there. More from the former Pentagon advisor and best-selling author of Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with former Pentagon advisor, best-selling economics author and editor of Strategic Intelligence, Jim Rickards. Jim, before I interrupted you, we were talking about elements of the Mar-a-Lago Accords, the military subservience element and the Treasury's angle on it. Just go on and tell me what you were in the middle of saying.
Yeah. The main point I was making is that, you know, talking about $37 trillion of debt, and that is the U.S. debt, like it's a big, scary number. It's not a very, it's kind of a content-free discussion. You have to, if you want to be serious analytically, you have to put that in the context of how much revenue or income do we have. In other words, the debt to GDP ratio. That matters. Right now, it's too high. I'll grant that. It's slowing growth. I've said many times, we've been in a depression since 2007. The U.S. has been in a depression, not a technical recession. We had a severe one in 2008, 2009, but we're in a prolonged, what we call long depression of slow growth and low growth since 2007, and the debt to GDP ratio hurts that. Now, so what's the key to making the Treasury market sustainable? The answer is you have to lower that ratio. You're not going to get rid of the deficits, and you're not going to get rid of the debt. Last time the U.S. was debt-free was 1836 under Andrew Jackson. But what you can do, as long as the deficit is growing more slowly than nominal GDP, and I emphasize the word nominal, not real, because real is nominal minus inflation, but debt is, and the debt to GDP ratio is a nominal concept. I like real numbers as much as anybody, but if I owe you a dollar, I owe you a dollar. It might be interesting if it's worth $1.05 or 95 cents, you know, according to some index, but contractually it's a dollar. So if you have 3% real growth and 2% inflation, which we do, you have 5% nominal growth. If you can keep the deficits at 3% or less of GDP, that means the numerator of the fraction is growing more slowly than the denominator. That means the ratio is going down. That's all the market has to say. They'll say, okay, U.S., finally, you got your act together. You're on the right course. And this is actually Scott Bessent's plan. And Moran echoes it in some ways. But this is Scott Bessent, Secretary of the Treasury's plan. Keep the deficits at 3% or less of GDP. Keep GDP at 3% real plus 2% inflation or higher, for that matter. So nominally, it's going 5% or more. Now your ratio is going down. By the way, the U.S. did this before. In 1945, our debt to GDP ratio was 114%, which was the second highest compared to where it is today. In 1980, it was 30%. How did we get from 114% to 30%, which is very comfortable, by the way? Well, actually, the deficits tripled, and the debt more than tripled. So how do we do it? We did it with growth, and that's the key. So, and growth, by the way, can nominal growth.
But growth isn't so much
element
in the Mar-a-Lago Accord. So let's just stick to that element of trying to get that numerator down. And surely the one impact, if certain elements of the Mar-a-Lago Accord are instituted by Donald Trump, what is the effect going to be on Western Europe? Because Western Europe, key ally, it's going to be even worse with the devaluation as an element, devaluation of the dollar as part of the accord element. I mean, they already destroyed the Nord Stream and the energy supplies of the strongest economy in Europe, Germany. Just give us an outline of what you think is going to be the future for Western Europe as regards its current policy trajectory.
Well, the vassals just have to bear it, so they won't have much say in the matter. But here's the thing with Europe. If there's one takeaway from the Mar-a-Lago Accord that I think is most important for investors, the U.S. dollar has been going down lately. It went up a little bit like a month ago, but over the last year, it has been going down. It's going to continue to go down or stay at these lower levels. That is not a sign of, you know, people fleeing the dollar, dumping the dollar. That's the narrative. The narrative is wrong. The U.S. Treasury is engineering this. It's very important to understand. This is like the Plaza Accord. This is like the petrodollar accord. By the way, from 1971 to 1980, measured by weight of gold, the U.S. dollar declined 96%. There's your crash. Don't look at the euro. Don't look at the euro-US dollar cross rate. Look at the price of gold. There's your crash. And that's happening in front of your eyes with gold now pushing $3,900 an ounce. So my point is the dollar is going to go down and stay down, not because people are fleeing it. They wish they had more, actually. It's because U.S. Treasury is engineering it. So don't fight the Treasury on this. And that is part of the Mar-a-Lago Accord.
And elites in Western Europe know this, but they can't do anything about it then? And along with the tariff policy, it'll be like a hurricane for Western Europe if there's dollar devaluation, which is engineered, plus the tariff threats. The troops are already there in the bases in Germany. I mean, sure. How is Western Europe going to survive? I mean,
Trump's job is to make America great again. His job is not to make Germany great again or make France great again. That's up to Merz and Macron and Starmer, who are all incompetent in various ways. But Germany has committed industrial suicide. I bought a German car recently. I like German cars, but I read all the specifications, and I saw the car was made in Germany, but the engine was made in Hungary. And I was like, I'm okay with that. The Hungarians are smart, and they're good engineers. But why is one of the biggest auto companies in Germany outsourcing their engine manufacturing to Hungary? The answer is energy costs. Germany and its allies blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. Hungary is still buying natural gas from Russia, so their energy costs are much lower, and they're more efficient producers. So Germany, under Merkel and continuing under Merz, they've shut down every coal-fired plant in Germany. They've shut down all but two nuclear plants in Germany. They put up windmills, which don't work, and solar panels, which, they work, but not at night, not in storm, and not in bad weather. So they put up completely inefficient power networks. They only had one thing going for them, one thing, which was Russian natural gas, and they blew line. So now Germany is in free fall. Their industrial economy is collapsing, but they've done it to themselves. This was not done by the United States or tariffs or dollars or anything else. They bought into the Green New Scam to their own detriment. Now they can't find a way out.
But we don't know the threats.
My original point.
We don't know the threats over Ukraine.
Sorry?
We don't know the private threats from intelligence agencies over Ukraine, of course. And Merz was a banker wasn't he? Was he at BlackRock, I think?
I'm not sure, but I'll grant that there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and a lot of it revolves around Ukraine. Ukraine is basically a money laundering machine for the U.S. Progressive politicians. They want to keep the machine going.
That's not what it says in the Japanese Financial Times. Why Ukraine is winning the war, says the Financial Times and the European press.
Yeah, well, they're not winning. They're not winning the war. That's nonsense. I mean, look. The Japanese papers may say that, but so do the Financial Times, the Economist,
British,
and New York
Times. Actually, I mean Japanese-owned Financial Times. It's thought of as a British newspaper.
Fair enough. Yeah, the Telegraph, the Guardian, they all say the same thing, and they're all wrong. They're either lying or ignorant. Russia is winning the war decisively. Now, here's the thing. Russia is winning the war the way Russia wins wars, which is slowly, methodically, and with total lethality. They'll spend a year surrounding a city before they attack it. But when they do, they give the Ukrainians a chance to surrender. Zelensky never does. They say, okay, surrender or die, and so we'll just come in and kill you, which they did to the elite troops in Kursk. They did it in Bakhmut, Avdiivka, Mariupol, and now they're going to do it to Pokrovsk. That's the next target. The Russians are decisively winning the war, but they're taking their time. And so everything else is a fairy tale. The Russians are winning.
Why do you think oil has not been used more as a weapon? I know that Russia is now the largest economy in Europe by a PPP after they went into Ukraine. I know you've been highlighting there are still dangers in the Russian economy as well as the war goes on. But there was an OPEC Plus meeting in the past 24 hours, 48 hours. Why is it that oil has not been used like in 1973 over Gaza, over Ukraine, do you think? Why are people talking actually about output increases rather than output cuts, as the Arabs countries could be saying over Gaza? Russia, of course, would benefit from an oil cut as output cut as well.
Well, the reason they're talking about increases is because the price is dropping. The price is dropping because of reduced demand. You just don't understand how slow the U.S. economy is right now. And again, we already talked about Europe. So demand is dropping. So it's not, they say, oversupply. Well, okay, when I studied economics, you had to look at supply and demand. The real reason prices are soft is because the demand is going down. Now, if you see supply increases, it just means they're fighting for market share. They're cutting each other's throats. By the way, I said to talked to Peter Navarro, who was in the White House a few months ago. And I said, Peter, if you want to end the war in Ukraine, basically get the price of oil down to $30. That'll get Putin's attention. You know, flying to Alaska for a summit meeting doesn't mean anything if oil is $65. Get oil to $30 and you'll get the Russians' attention. So, you know, drill, baby, drill, open up drilling in the Gulf of America, East Coast, West Coast, Alaska, you know, et cetera. And that will sink the price of oil. Now, why they don't do that, I'm not sure, unless it's the oil companies, you know, lobbying for higher prices to the extent they can. But if you really want to stop Russia, the only way to do it is to get oil at $30.
Which is what Trump has been saying. But as you say, it's a mystery why they're not seeking to... can we expect then some moves then by OPEC Plus to balance those attempts by the Trump administration, and at least oil will be stable then and not continue its decline?
Yeah, no, I think the U.S. is determined to... this part of... we talked earlier about Scott Bessent's plan. It was called the Three Arrows. And the first arrow was deficits below 3% of GDP. The second arrow was real growth 3% or higher, with nominal growth 5% or higher. But the third arrow was increasing U.S. production by 3 million barrels a day. So it was 3-3-3. And that takes time. That can't be done overnight, but that's still coming on stream. So I would expect oil prices to decline. But Russia may have won the war in the meantime. By the way, Russia has made, you know, we have all these sanctions and the U.S. is trying to steal $300 billion of lawfully purchased U.S. Treasury securities that Russia owns that are in a depository in Belgium. But Russia has made $100 billion with the price of gold going up. I mean, the irony, because Elvira Nabiullina, who's the head of the Central Bank of Russia, I say she's the only central bank in the world who actually knows her job. She spent 10 years getting gold at 25% of Russia's reserves. But as the U.S. and NATO threatened to steal the Russian treasury securities, confidence in the dollar is lost, the price of gold goes up, and Russia's making a fortune on the gold. So Russia's actually doing quite well out of this.
Jim Rickards, thank you. And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the US-UK EU armed genocide in Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch by all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.